Chapter 13. Infarct. Noun. A small, localized area of dead tissue caused by an inadequate blood supply. On one of my regular trips to the neurosurgical department in America, where I have an honorary teaching post, I delivered a lecture entitled All My Worst Mistakes. It had been inspired by Daniel Kahneman's book Thinking Fast and Slow, a brilliant account, published in 2011, of the limits of human reason and of the way in which we all suffer from what psychologists call cognitive biases. I found it consoling when thinking about some of the mistakes I have made in my career to learn that errors of judgment and the propensity to make mistakes are, so to speak, built into the human brain. I felt that perhaps I could be forgiven for some of the mistakes I have made over the years. Everybody accepts that we all make mistakes and that we learn from them. The problem is that when doctors such as myself make mistakes, the consequences can be catastrophic for our patients. Most surgeons, there are always a few exceptions, feel a deep sense of shame when their patients suffer or die as a result of their efforts, a sense of shame which is made all the worse if litigation follows. Surgeons find it difficult to admit to making mistakes, to themselves as well as to others, and there are all manner of ways in which they disguise their errors and try to put the blame elsewhere. Yet, as I approach the end of my career, I feel an increasing obligation to bear witness to past mistakes I have made, in the hope that my trainees will learn how not to make the same mistakes themselves. Inspired by Kahneman's book, I set out to remember all my worst mistakes. For several months, each morning, I would lie in bed before getting up to head off for my daily run round the local park, thinking over my career. It was a painful experience. The more I thought about the past, the more mistakes rose to the surface, like poisonous methane stirred up from a riverbed. Many had been submerged for years. I also found that if I did not immediately write them down, I would often forget them all over again. Some, of course, I have never forgotten, and that has usually been because the consequences for myself had been especially unpleasant. When I delivered my lecture to my American colleagues, it was met by a stunned silence and no questions were asked. For all I know, they may have been stunned not so much by my reckless honesty as by my incompetence. Surgeons are supposed to talk about their mistakes at regular morbidity and mortality meetings, where avoidable mistakes are discussed and lessons learned. But the ones I have attended, both in America and in my own department, are usually rather tame affairs, with the doctors present reluctant to criticize each other in public. Although there is much talk of the need for doctors to work in a blame-free culture, it is very difficult in practice to achieve this. Only if the doctors hate each other or are locked in furious competition, usually over private practice, which means money, will they criticize each other more openly. And even then, it is more often behind each other's backs. One of the mistakes I discussed in my lecture, and which I had not forgotten, involved a young man who had been admitted to the old hospital shortly before it closed. My registrar, in fact, one of the American trainees who were sent from their department in Seattle to work in London in my hospital for a year as part of their training, came to find me and asked me to look at a scan. We walked from my office to the X-ray viewing room. This was before the X-ray system had been computerized and the patient's brain scans were all on large sheets of film. They were kept on chrome and steel frames on which the films were hung like washing on a line, each frame on roller bearings so that the frames could be pulled out smoothly one by one. The system was like an antique Rolls-Royce, old-fashioned but beautifully engineered. Provided that you had highly efficient X-ray secretaries, which we did, the system was completely reliable and quite unlike the computers that now dominate my working life. My registrar pulled out some scans in front of me. "He's a 32-year-old man at St. Richard's. Apparently he's become paralysed down the left side," he told me. The scan showed a large, dark area on the right side of the man's brain. To the man with a hammer, it is said, all things look like nails. When brain surgeons look at brain scans, they see things that they think require surgery, and I am, alas, no exception. I looked at the scan quickly. I was already late for my outpatient clinic. I agreed with my registrar that it was probably a tumour, but one which was impossible to remove. All that could be done would be a biopsy operation where a small part of the tumour would be removed and sent for analysis. I told him to bring the patient over to our hospital for this to be done. In retrospect, I was careless. I should have asked more questions about the history, and if I had been given the right information, which admittedly I might not have been since it was all at second hand, I would probably have looked more critically at the scans or asked for my neuroradiologist's opinion. So the young man was transferred to the neurosurgical unit. My registrar duly carried out the biopsy operation. A minor and relatively safe operation done through a half-inch hole drilled in the skull that took less than an hour. The analysis came back that the abnormality was not a tumour, but an infarct. He had suffered a stroke, unusual in a man his age, but not unheard of. In retrospect, it was rather obvious that this was what the scan had shown, and I had misinterpreted it. I was embarrassed, but not especially troubled. It did not seem too terrible a mistake to make, and a stroke seemed better than a malignant tumour. The patient was transferred back to the local hospital to be investigated for the cause of his stroke. I thought nothing more about it. 2 years later, I received a copy of a long letter written in a shaky, elderly hand from the man's father. The letter had been sent to the hospital and passed on to me for my comments by the complaints office, recently renamed by the new chief executive as the Complaints and Improvements Department. The letter accused me of being responsible for the death of his son, who had died several months after being transferred back to the local hospital. His father was certain he had died because of the operation. I invariably become very anxious when I receive letters of complaint. Every day I will make several dozen decisions that, if they are wrong, can have terrible consequences. My patients desperately need to believe in me, and I need to believe in myself as well. The delicate tightrope walking act of brain surgery is made all the worse by the constant pressure to get patients in and out of hospital as quickly as possible. When I receive one of these letters, or one from a solicitor announcing the intention of a patient of mine to sue me, I am forced to see the great distance beneath the rope on which I am balancing and the ground below. I feel as though I am about to fall into a frightening world where the usual roles are reversed, a world in which I am powerless and at the mercy of patients who are guided by suave, invulnerable lawyers who, to confuse me even further, are dressed in respectable suits just as I am and speak in the same self-confident tones. I feel that I have lost all the credibility and authority that I wear like armour when I do my round on the wards or when I open a patient's head in the operating theatre. I called in the dead man's notes and learned that he had died from a further stroke caused by a disease affecting the blood vessels in his brain that had resulted from the first stroke, which I had misinterpreted as a tumour.